UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
All right, let's come to order again. It is important to recognize, I think, that the kind of fundamental epistemological structures I am talking about transcend any particular philosophical movement. They're more foundational. What that means is that long after René Descartes has gone to his reward, modernism may nevertheless persist for three centuries. Likewise, today in France, Jacques Derrida is virtually unknown. Michel Foucault is almost as unknown. Jacques Derrida is better known in America today than he is in France. So la déconstruction, as historically developed by some of these thinkers, is on the decline. Americans don't know it yet, but it is. On the other hand, that does not mean that postmodernism is on the decline. Because the fundamental streams that have generated this kind of epistemological structure may themselves decline as philosophical systems without necessarily overturning the system by the decline of the source. Epistemological structures that are deeply embedded in a culture are not easy to overturn. They can take quite some time. So that modernism, you see, could withstand the impact of the Romantic period. It could withstand Kant and adapt and adopt the insights of various movements along the line and still remain pretty stable. Now, I do not think that postmodernism will last as long as modernism. I do not think so. On the other hand, just because people say that Jacques Derrida is now passé does not mean that postmodernism is on the edge of obliteration. I just do not see yet myself anything on the horizon that promises a big change. You see, I see individuals who pass through postmodernism and come out the other side with some ill-defined eclecticism. But an ill-defined eclecticism does not constitute a movement that can withstand an articulated movement. An eclecticism never does. You see, in fact, an eclecticism is itself part of the postmodern phenomenon. And so I suspect that postmodernism is with us at least for a few decades and maybe for a much longer period of time. Now, I could imagine some historical contingencies that could change that, at least temporarily. World War would do it. Major war, really major war, generates all kinds of absolutes really fast. They're not very well thought through, but it does generate all kinds of absolutes really fast, do you see? And they may not be very stable, so that after the war, they're overturned pretty fast, too. But it's easy to imagine all kinds of historical contingencies that could throw monkey wrenches in these things. And I'm neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, and I work for a non-profit organization. So that as a result, I'm leery of predicting where things are going to go. But if modernism lasted 350 years, it is surely true to say that the pace of change in Western culture is today much faster, partly because of the speed of our communications, for all kinds of reasons it's faster. And there's no way postmodernism, which is far more absurdist in any case, is going to be stable for three centuries. There's just no way that it is. But what comes next, I don't have any idea. I have no idea at all. I could imagine catastrophic results in war, decay, degeneration. I could. I could imagine revival and reformation too. I could imagine all kinds of things, but I don't know. There are too many contingencies. Most people who play the game of futurology play it by examining the trends of the last few years and then extrapolating along similar lines in the future, you see, and then trying to throw in projections about responses to these things and that sort of thing. But if history teaches us anything, it's that trends don't last very long. So I'm really nervous about playing those sorts of games. So if you ask me, do I think that postmodernism is with us for quite some time? Yes. Do I think that the current structures of thought that have fed into them are going to prove enduring? They're already fading. Other things are coming along. That has to be understood, you see. I have not, moreover, dealt with all the strands. I've merely picked up a few representative ones. I have not talked about the influence of Wittgenstein, for example, in language game theory. Especially later Wittgenstein. There are really two periods of Wittgenstein. I haven't talked about these sorts of things that could be usefully explored. I've merely tried to give representative streams that have fed into these patterns. Now what I want to do for a few minutes before we start coming to evaluation and response, I want to lay out what I call some of the correlatives of postmodernism. By correlatives, I mean not things that are simple causes of postmodernism, nor simply the outflow or results of postmodernism, but things which could be either. That is, things which can strengthen the hand of postmodernism and things which are themselves strengthened by postmodernism. They can be either and both. And so I prefer to speak of them merely as the correlatives of postmodernism. Let me give you one example, and then once I've given you the example and show how it works, you'll see right away, and then I can list a lot of others far more quickly, and I don't need to say so much about them. Consider, for example, the decline in biblical literacy. Now, how far the decline has progressed depends vastly on which country you are in Europe. Amongst many countries in Central and Eastern Europe, amongst those who are not religious, but really who have been brought up in the Marxist system, their ignorance of biblical categories is virtually absolute. But in Western Europe, increasingly because of the pressures of secularization, in fact, it's almost equivalently absolute in the new generation. On the other hand, in a place like Ireland, although the move in that direction is very rapid, there is still much more living memory of the church and its influence, and people have been brought up in catechetical schools and this sort of thing. So whether they believe it or not anymore is another issue. Whether it's at the top of their mind is another issue, but there still is something of that residue there, you see? Norway still has a far higher percentage of people who are biblically informed than Sweden does, just across the border. And so one has to be very careful about making generalizations in this regard. Having said that, the drift throughout the Western world is toward massive biblical illiteracy. When I speak at university missions today, I still try to do a couple a year, I now have to presuppose that the non-Christians in my audience have to have explained to them the difference between the big numbers and the little numbers. They don't know the difference between chapter and verse. See, I always explain text and I print out the text. And I have to explain the big numbers and the little numbers. They don't know anything. And when it comes to explaining scripture, I mean, they don't know the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. They don't know those terms. Their very limited religious vocabulary, faith, God, Jesus, hope, truth, in every case means something different from what I mean. In every single case means something different from what I mean. One of my students was in downtown Chicago a couple of years ago with his fiancée. She was wearing around her neck a chain, a gold chain, with a little wooden cross suspended from it. And a teenager stopped them on the street and said, "What are you wearing a plus sign around your neck for?" And you realize, you see, that there is some loss that's gone on there somewhere, if you see, in terms of a public awareness and icon. And that's in Chicago, do you see? Now, there are parts of Bible Belt America where Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is sometimes considered the buckle on the Bible Belt, where you will find many people on the street who would call themselves Christians, and not that many people who would admit to not being a Christian. On the other hand, you can go to the New England states or the Pacific Northwest, and the biblical ignorance is as profound as anywhere in Europe. Anywhere in Europe. Entire towns of 15, 20,000 people without a confessional church of any sort that's doing anything. Now, clearly, biblical illiteracy and postmodernism are not the same thing. On the other hand, where you have rising biblical illiteracy, then clearly you are open to input from more and more and more sources. If you have a population that is profoundly knowledgeable about Scripture, it is likely to be fairly suspicious of some of the claims of postmodern epistemology. Thus, you see, the rising biblical illiteracy strengthens the hand of postmodernism. But conversely, the postmodernism itself will strengthen the drift toward biblical illiteracy. Granted that there are many, many, many different perspectives religiously and in every other way, why should I read the Bible particularly? Why not read Saf or the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or whatever? Do you see? And thus, biblical illiteracy is neither simply a cause of postmodernism nor a result. It's both in some ways. It's a correlative of postmodernism. That's what I mean by these correlatives of postmodernism. Then in this regard, then, there are quite a few of them that are worth thinking about quickly. I don't have time to go through them in detail. But the processes of secularization, that's neither cause nor effect, but it's a bit of both. Most people talk about the processes of secularization not as the abolition, the move toward the abolition of religion, but the move toward the marginalization of religion. So you can be ever so religious, it just doesn't matter. Religion becomes something that is squeezed into one small domain of your life. But it doesn't shape your morals, doesn't shape your ethics, doesn't shape your politics, doesn't shape your goals, doesn't shape your self-identity. It's something that you do on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. And there is an enormous amount of secularization, thus, of religion in the Western world. Where there is religion, there is an awful lot of secularized religion. Now, there are some wonderful exceptions, of course, but that is still quite common. And clearly, then, where you have secularization of religion, then you are strengthening the hand of postmodernism because your religion doesn't matter. It's not worldview forming. It's not shaping, do you see? But likewise, postmodernism is going to strengthen the hand of secularization as well. You can be ever so religious, whether this religion or that religion or something. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because you're not allowed to make an absolute truth claim of it. If it's not an absolute truth claim, then it's a subjective thing, do you see? And if it helps you, fine, God bless you, go in peace, my son. But it doesn't mean anything beyond that. Likewise, this affects your understanding of morality, right and wrong, for exactly the same sorts of reasons. Rising immorality, from a biblical point of view, will feed into postmodernism, but postmodernism itself will also feed into more and more subjectivity in the domain of morality. And I mean morality, not merely sexual morality, but right across the whole suite of things. So that in most Western countries, until about 40 years ago, you could manage all kinds of business deals with a handshake and a brief contract because there was often a kind of inherited integrity that was simply presupposed. You didn't want to lose face, even if you weren't a Christian. So you kept your word. See, nowadays, there is more and more business ethics that is circumscribed entirely by endless lawyers writing endless contracts, trying to protect against every conceivable way of manipulating things, because we've become a more and more litigious society. The question is how to win, not what's faithful or true. Likewise, in the domain of the whole legal system, there is less and less appeal to natural law and that sort of thing, and more appeal to positive law, which is merely the will of the people established by Parliament, do you see? Similarly, in the domain of tolerance, the very definition of tolerance has changed. It's important to see this. It's very difficult to understand what's going on in the domain of tolerance without seeing that the definition of tolerance has changed. In American universities, less so than in Europe, more so than in Europe, rather, many American universities have some mechanism for a public lecture. Any group on campus can invite in a known scholar and give a public lecture. And it can be in any domain of thought whatsoever. And the university will pay for the person to come in and give a lecture, two lectures, three lectures, and go away again. Do you see? And it's no part of the curriculum. It's not owned by any particular department. It's part of a way of trying to enrich diversity of perspective and bring in visiting scholars and this sort of thing. And because Christian groups are also part of the whole structure of universities, a campus crusade group or an intervarsity group or something like this, then they can put in their bids to invite somebody in. And it could be somebody talking about nuclear physics or talking about public policy or talking about war or it can be anything at all. And it's not supposed to be overtly evangelistic or anything like that, but it can be in the domain of religion and so on. So every once in a while I get invited to give a public lecture somewhere. Some group or other has invited me to go in and give some public lectures at a university on something. And in two or three instances, I've gone in to give some public lectures under the title, The Intolerance of Tolerance. And inevitably, that topic in North America, I suspect it would have a similar effect in many universities here, can pack the place. My most recent one was the University of Northern Carolina, and we had more than 1,000 people show up for this thing, and probably 40% of them not Christians in any sense. And it's important to understand that the notion of tolerance then within this framework has itself a certain intellectual heritage that has been transmuted by postmodernism. Under the modernist paradigm, tolerance looked something like this. I may disagree with you, but I insist on your right to articulate your opinion, however stupid and ignorant I think it is. That's tolerance. In other words, this means that there is tolerance for the individual to say things with which I disagree. The tolerance is directed toward individuals. But there is robust debate at the level of content and substance. So I may disagree profoundly with Marx's historiography, but if I'm a tolerant person under a modernist regime, I insist on the right of Marx's historiographers to articulate their views. But likewise, under the Western vision of tolerance, under a modernist camp, then I insist on the right of capitalists to articulate their views, or theists to articulate their views, or whatever, however right or wrong I think they are. So that unless there is something deeply, deeply damaging to public well-being, as, for example, somebody coming along and advocating vociferously pedophilia, then the notion of tolerance allows you to defend almost anybody teaching almost anything. Because, you see, under the modernist paradigm, the assumption is that in the marketplace of disputed ideas, the truth will come out. There is a truth to be searched out. There is a truth to be pursued. Truth, ultimately, is desirable and attainable. So, in other words, this view of tolerance is itself tied to a certain kind of vision of truth, a certain kind of epistemology. But once you change the epistemology and lose that vision of truth, tolerance itself is redefined. Now tolerance means that you must not say that anybody is wrong. That's the one wrong thing to say. But now notice, under this view of tolerance, you are tolerant not of individuals. You are tolerant of all positions. The tolerance is now directed toward all views that are articulated, because you are not in a position to say that any view is wrong. The one thing that is not tolerated is the view that this view of tolerance is wrong. And thus you have the intolerance of tolerance. Worse, if somebody comes along and says this view of tolerance is wrong, under this view of tolerance, that view, that person is not tolerant, and therefore should not be tolerated. That person is a bigot. And because there is no understanding of tolerance directed toward the individual, but only towards all views, except that view which says that this view of tolerance is wrong, therefore the university campus can become a very scary place toward anybody who says that there may be an absolute right and wrong after all, or an absolute truth. I would argue that this new view of tolerance is, in fact, logically incoherent. I don't simply mean that it is inconsistent, that is, it proves intolerant. I don't mean that. It isn't consistent, but I mean something worse than that. I think that it is incoherent. Because the very notion of tolerance, under whatever regime, presupposes that you have to disagree with someone or something before you tolerate it. You see, if I say, on my university campus, I will tolerate those who propagate Islam, or Marxism, or whatever, it doesn't matter, I have to disagree with it before I can use the word tolerate. If I say, well, you know, you're no more right nor wrong than I am, I may agree with you. I tolerate you. It's incoherent. That doesn't even make sense. To be able to tolerate something, you've got to disagree with it in the first place. But if, in fact, you are not in a position to say that any position is wrong, how can you speak of tolerating it? Thus, I would argue that the new definition of tolerance is not only inconsistent, it's incoherent, and proves, in fact, to be less tolerant than the brand of tolerance that was around under modernism. Because at the very point where it comes up with that which disagrees with it the most, it has to dismiss all opponents as intolerant and bigoted, and therefore becomes, in fact, totalitarian. Now, when I argue for this position on a university campus, it generates immense discussions. It's wonderful fun, because people intrinsically begin to see that there is an argument here. You see, there is something here. And they go, oh, am I actually intolerant? They all want to be tolerant, because tolerant is a positive word. Am I actually intolerant? And so it generates all kinds of discussions and opens up then a wedge to talk about how Christians will view tolerance in this framework. And so that's how I start bringing in Christianity through the back door frame of reference. But all I'm saying by this is that postmodern epistemology is not something that is reserved for intellectual eggheads in philosophy departments. It is something that is part of the atmosphere we breathe. It is the kind of thing that is presented in most of our media. It is the kind of thing that is presupposed in most of our religious discussions and so on today. And, of course, this also vastly affects how we view evangelism. Evangelism is now viewed as a subset of proselytization. Proselytization is intrinsically evil under postmodernism, if there is a category for evil. Precisely because in evangelism you are trying to win someone to another position. If you're trying to win someone to another position, then you are implicitly saying that their position is inferior to yours. And that is the one thing you must not do. So it is all right to give your testimony. You tell your story about how Jesus means something to you, and Mahmoud tells his story about how Muhammad means something to him, and the local Thai visiting scholar explains how Buddhism is something that generates a lot of peace for him, and on and on and on, you see. But you can't say that any one view is right or wrong, or any one stance is superior or not superior. That you must not do. So suddenly, you open your New Testament and you find yourself in another world. The New Testament speaks of the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Paul speaks of the gospel such that if anybody preach another gospel, let him be anathema. Jesus himself insists we're to bear witness and make disciples of men and women from all nations. The ultimate eschatological vision pictures men and women from every tongue and tribe and people and nation. And you see, within that kind of framework, inevitably Christian witness will be viewed as an intrinsically bigoted, right-wing, old-fashioned, nasty piece of work. That's my encouraging thought for the day. Oh, well, we'll come to that. I haven't begun to answer it yet. Give me some space here.
What would this all, what effect would all this have on organized religion and on the, it seems like in the rise of postmodernism, the world has become more religious. Religions are becoming more primitive. Islam is becoming more fundamental, and so it seems evangelicalism and Protestantism in some, many countries is becoming, and Catholicism too, is becoming more fundamental. Is postmodernism, epistemology, having a kind of counterbalancing effect within organized religion?
This is very complex, in my view. In the first place, postmodernism is not found equivalently all around the world. I've been speaking primarily of North America and Europe. But postmodernism is found in surprising places or something similar. Did you hear his question back there by and large? Yes, okay. Repeat it for posterity. Yes. Oh, I see. You were lost. You were lost. Yes. The question is something like this. There were really a couple of components to it. What effect does postmodernism have on organized religion? When you start looking around, in some ways, there are more spiritualities, more religious fervor today than in yesterday. And after all, in some places, there's a sort of a rising fundamentalism, whether in Islam or in some brands of Christian thought. How do these sorts of developments tie into the rise of postmodernism? Is that correct?
Yes.
what I said by way of preliminary response is that most of my analysis so far has been restricted to what has gone on in Europe and in North America. And postmodernism is not developing in all parts of the world. That has to be said. On the other hand, postmodernism does extend in slightly different forms in more parts of the world than we sometimes think. I had an African student 2 or 3 years ago, one of the most gifted African PhD students I've ever had. He wasn't in my department. He was really in systematics, not New Testament, but I was asked to supervise him because he was writing in the domain of postmodernism, and I had published in that area quite a bit and so on. So he'd come to ask me some questions, and I ended up supervising him. And he was from Zaire. And he wanted to write a dissertation that had to do with how Christians should respond to the postmodern critique in Francophone West Africa. And I thought, my dear brother, there are parts of West Africa, I've been to Africa often enough, there are parts of West Africa that haven't escaped pre-modern epistemology yet. I mean, give me a break. And so my initial response was that, you're living in cloud cuckoo land, you know, what do you think you're doing? And then he convinced me that he was right. Because the pressures were different, the terms were different. But in the 1940s and 1950s, there was a movement in French West Africa that was called la négritude. That's almost impossible to translate. The negrofying, you can't translate it that way. But la négritude was really a movement of young French-speaking black intellectuals who were trying to find intellectual roots for overthrowing the colonial powers. And one way of overthrowing the colonial sense of superiority that you got from Belgium and France, we are the tradition, was by relativizing all traditions in order to leave a place for la négritude, for blackness, for black culture, for African culture, and so on, you see? Now, the movement La Négritude has now died away. It's not a movement anymore. But it became part of a kind of African version of the relativizing of all cultures in order to provide a place for sub-Saharan African black culture, especially in the French mold, you see? And then these young intellectuals, and in any case, because they've been brought up in French-speaking schools, they had been exposed to Lacan and Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault and so on themselves, so that by the time you get to the 70s, they have deeply imbibed of all of this stuff and transmuted into an African context, so that in African intellectual circles, as opposed to churches out in the bush, then obviously now the rising number of cities in the movement of urbanization, the rising number of universities and so on, then suddenly there is a major need for thinking through how you address those sorts of questions there. Do you see? In that sense, in intellectual circles in Africa, you're facing these sorts of problems. As late as 1963, Nairobi had no university. Now it's got four. And still most pastors have been taught in bush league schools, you see, maybe with a primary education and a bit of Bible Institute somewhere, and they're trying to preach to thousands of university graduates. You see, it's appalling. So all over Africa, you hear the cry: the pews are higher than the pulpit. And within that framework, this chap was trying to think through how to develop an apologetic and a structure of thought, you see, for winning back. So in that sense, you see, postmodernism is extending with different forms and variations in parts of the world that are surprisingly different from Europe, but facing similar sorts of problems. This is part of the process of globalization, too, it seems to me. On the other hand, Muslim fundamentalism forms very little part of that. Nor does Hindu fundamentalism in northern India, and so on. It has to be acknowledged that when you get more and more things opened up, then there can also be a backlash. One of the shrewdest analysts of Islam, in my judgment, is a chap called Bernard Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. His first book, published 35 years ago, was translated simultaneously into Hebrew and Arabic. It was published by the Israeli Information Ministry and the Muslim Brotherhood. It's probably the only book that's ever been written in English about which that has happened. But he is so careful and even-handed in his analysis of things, you see. He is very, very good indeed. And he's written a lot of books since then. But by all means, poke him up on Amazon.com, Bernard Lewis, and read two or three of his books. He is very, very, very shrewd. Now, one of the things that he points out is that Muslim fundamentalism is not so much afraid of the Christian West. It is afraid of the secular West. It has a place for people of the book. We're not the people of the book anymore. And when the West speaks of globalization, what it really means is the multiplication of postmodern relativism, immorality, and secularization. Besides senses of inferiority and all kinds of other things, but that's one of the things that he points out, you see? So likewise, when you have the multiplication of relativism of one sort or another, then inevitably you're going to get right-wing reactions of one sort or another too. whether in Islam or in Christianity or in Hinduism or whatever. And so the world becomes complex, doesn't it? In my view, one of the better analyses of world movements in this regard is the writing of Samuel Huntington. Are you familiar with that name? Samuel Huntington published an article in 1993 in the prestigious journal Foreign Affairs, in which he invented the term, the clash of cultures. It was the most widely read article ever published by Foreign Affairs and created a firestorm of debate and so on. And unrepentant, he published a whole book called The Clash of Cultures, which is still worth reading, published in 1997. Pardon? The Clash of Civilizations, rather. That's right. The Clash of Civilizations. And published in 1997. And in which he predicted, amongst other things, for example, that with... what he is really arguing is that in the Western world, we have tended to think of things for 70 years in terms of East versus West, Marxism versus capitalism, the communist empire versus the allies. That's what we've tended to think of things. Now we're post-1989. So what's going on now? Well, Fukuyama published a book called The End of History, in which he argued, in effect, that with this clash gone, now we've come to the end of conflict, and although there are a lot of regional struggles that will continue, we've come to the end of any need for war, and we're moving into a broader peace in which liberal democracy will eventually triumph, and we've come to the end of history. Looks a little less like that today. And meanwhile, then, the response was Samuel Huntington, in which he is really arguing that there are 8 major civilizations around the world which have their own structures of thought and value systems and tendencies and belief things and so on. And they don't want to be part of the Western secularized world. I mean, we think of ourselves as being on the front end, but although they might want our trinkets and our science, that doesn't mean they want our value systems and our structures, and sometimes not our democracy and other things too. They certainly don't want our immorality. So within that framework, then, he predicted, he said that one of the crucial elements of those who are outside of power is to use terrorism. But he said sooner or later, terrorists will gain weapons of mass destruction. Terrorism, he says, is the argument of the weak. But sooner or later, terrorists will gain weapons of mass destruction, and then the weak will be strong. And then it will change everything. Now, that's very interesting, isn't it? That was published in 1993, and then came out again in 1997. Now, people are less likely to sneer at Samuel Huntington. And Huntington is not a Christian. But all I'm saying is that when one starts looking at world pressures, then there are a lot of other things to throw in besides questions of postmodernism. So if you're becoming a missionary to Nepal, postmodernism is not the most important thing for you to learn. On the other hand, and if you're going to become a Christian working behind the scenes in northern India, again, postmodernism is not the most important thing to understand. But if we're focusing primarily on Europe, which is where most of us live and move and have our being, then this is something that we really do have to understand. And because of the pressures of globalization and instant communication, whether we like it or not, we're influenced by other things, and other things influence us too. So one of the impacts on us is the rising pressure of Eastern religions. You see, which was not a factor 50 years ago, but is a factor increasingly. Whether it's Islam, in any given weekend in France, there are twice as many Muslims worshiping as there are Catholics. And who could have imagined 25 years ago a major mosque in Regent Park in London? I mean, not conceivable. Now it's simply the given. And so these sorts of, whether it's that or whether it's Buddhism or whatever, there are changing structures, and these diversities are not all easily containable within the category of postmodernism.
Can I add on?
Yeah.
How is the American, in your opinion, we're, a lot of us are not Americans or do not live in America, but how has the American church been influenced by postmodernism? What is the effect of postmodernism on American evangelicalism?
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends. Again, sometimes there's a right-wing reaction. But in ordinary evangelicalism, you can find this whether in America or in Europe. 35 years ago, when I was being taught principles of inductive Bible study, for example, in a university campus, it worked like this. The person who was leading an inductive Bible study was taught to prepare the passage in advance. And the inductive Bible study, the discussion and that sort of thing, it was a means of getting people to understand what the text said. So in the discussion, Charles comes up with an interpretation that is right off the wall. And the person who's prepared this text says, Charles, where do you find that in the text? Well, I just sort of think it's sort of presupposed in verse 13. Well, Mary, do you agree with Charles? No, I think Charles is all wet. I think it really means such and such. Charles, how would you respond to me? So you get the discussion going, you see, to try to get to a consensus of what the text really means and then apply it to life. That's the way inductive Bible studies work. And they were supposed to be quite a lot of fun and at the same time grappling with the text to try to see what the text actually says. Do you see? But nowadays, that's not where it works. In most evangelical churches, Charles comes up with some interpretation that's really screwball, right off the wall. And the leader is now trained to say, well, that's a very interesting insight. Does anybody else have anything to say? Because, you see, the one thing you're not allowed to say anymore is that somebody's got it wrong. But that's part of the impact of postmodernism too, isn't it? And what it means is that sooner or later, the word can no longer function as the norming norm. It can no longer function to reform and correct and instruct. It can be domesticated. And it seems to me that that has to be opposed in pretty substantial ways. Now, how to do that, I'll come to in due course if we can get off this and get on to the next thing. Yes?
There are certain streams within organized Christianity, different denominations and churches, as Christian fundamentalism. Are we going to touch also this in your future discussion?
Mary, would you mind shutting that down a bit? I can't hear questions very well up here. No, it's my middle-aged ears and a combination of slight accents, and I don't pick them all up. Would you mind re-articulating your question?
Yeah. Some communist Christians are sometimes labeled as Christian fundamentalists. Are you going to touch also this subject later? You have labeled those bigoted right-wing or messy
yes.
things.
Yes.
Yeah, communists and let us say those people who are yes. Christians are yes. trying to present those traditional values in improper or only modern.
Yes. Give me a little time now. Yeah. I want to start coming back on this, okay? Now, what time do we go to? 1:15?
Yes.
So I've only got half an hour. All right, let me let me do what I can. And tell me, would anybody be terribly upset if I lap into tomorrow's material for another half hour to push this a little farther? We're pretty much the same group. There are a couple of... So if we run out of time, we might run into tomorrow by half an hour a bit and before we start tackling tomorrow's material, unless there are huge objections, there's false advertising and I'm threatened to be sued or something. let me begin then now by way of response by saying, first of all, some of the advantages of postmodernism. See, it's very important that we do not simply dismiss postmodernism. We don't want to develop a knee-jerk conservative reaction here as if modernism has always been the friend of Christians. It has not always been the friend of Christians. So let me, first of all, begin by saying some positive things about postmodernism. Number one. Postmodernism has very effectively, sometimes too much, but very effectively critiqued the arrogance of modernism. It has often exposed the arrogance that is engendered by a form of epistemology that begins with the autonomous, finite self. Which is what modernism did. It begins with the autonomous, finite self. I think, therefore I am. Postmodernism has been very effective at showing the limitations of that sort of approach. I could give you many examples, but I press on. Number two, it has also been very effective at demonstrating the genuine differences that finite human beings bring to any discussion. For 10 years, I worked part-time, only part-time, with an organization called the World Evangelical Fellowship. And it was part of my job to bring together scholars and senior pastors from around the world to in small study conferences. I would assign papers in advance. And then after everybody wrote the papers on these related topics, we would come together in one convenient center, and the papers would have been printed and circulated in advance, and we'd come in and we'd discuss them. We'd go through them paragraph by paragraph by paragraph, and then they would all go home and revise them again. They would come back to me and edit them, and it would pop a book, you see? So in 10 years, on a two-year cycle, we produced 5 books this way that were written then by people from around the world. And it was very interesting just watching these people come into the room, you know. In would come the German, shake everybody's hand. You know. If he went out of the room to catch something from his car, he'd have to shake everybody's hand on the way out, you see. And then in would come the Indian, and you get a lot of, you know, this going on. In would come the Japanese, and there the hands are down, and you bow. But how far down you bow, well, that depends on a lot of factors. It's very difficult for an outsider to sort that one out. How old you are, how young you are, how many degrees you've got, how much money you've got, whether you're senior in the church, whether you're a bishop, whatever. You see, it's all very complex about how far down you get. I never get this right. Just sort of bow in the general direction and hope that you're not too insulting. I mean, what do? You see? Then in would come... In would come one of the Latins, you know, Mexico or Spain, you know. Brother! Well, you know, I can just about put up with that. I was brought up in French Canada, despite my British roots. Both my parents were born in the UK, but I was brought up, I didn't put up with that, you know. When I go to Latin America, with my British roots, I like about 36 inches distance. Latin America, it's 18 inches distance, you know. I always feel they're crowding my space. They think that I'm cold and distant, you know. So I started some experiments, you know. You start talking, they get right in my face like that, you know. So I started backing up and putting my foot out to see what would happen. They'd step on it. And we're just coming into the room, you know. I remember Pablo Perez from Mexico. All 300 pounds of him, coming into this conference to an Englishman who, he was quintessentially, I won't even tell you his name because many of you would know it. He was quintessentially English. He was standing in a corner, somewhat bemused by this pack of people, in a quintessentially English Harris tweed suit coat with his hands behind his back. And Pablo Perez, who recognized him just as an author, you see, he knew who he was. He'd never met the man before. He was, brother! And he was coming to him, about to embrace him in a 300-pound hug. And the Englishman said, have we been introduced? Wonderful, wonderful. And then in comes the American. Hi, everybody. Sorry I'm late. At this point, they're just coming into the room, you know. You haven't started the discussion yet, you know. And I was always in the chair for these things. And my job was to try to get everybody participating. And I look around the room, and there's some cultures that are going to participate more than other cultures, let me tell you. So eventually, I would turn to the Japanese, you know, Masao Enuma or somebody or other. Brother, I haven't heard your judgment on this matter. Well, it occurs to me that perhaps the blessed Apostle Paul is... well, he could be taken to be saying, perhaps, that this verse should be read this way. Do you think? And the brother from Norway pipes up. That's not what it means at all. It means it's straightforward, what it really clearly means. the brother from Japan now wonders what sort of group of barbarians he is following. You see, there is a sense in which postmodernism has helped us to recognize some of these differences a little more, hasn't it? You see, we do not all think the same way. And some cultures think more laterally than others. And we're not all linear thinkers, and not all forms of culture want argumentation that goes right for the center of things. They want to circle around it. They want to circle around it, go around and round and round and round, hope to cycle in on something. I mean, there are all kinds of genuine differences that postmodernism has exposed us to. In fact, in one sense, I would argue that postmodernism hasn't gone far enough. Postmodernism stresses our finitude. It does not stress our sinfulness. But a knowledgeable Christian will admit not only our finitude, but also what has traditionally been called the noetic effects of the fall. In other words, because of sin, we're not only limited, we're stupid, perverse. Postmodernism has rightly shown, it seems to me, that all human knowing is in some measure culturally constrained. Now, that doesn't mean that I agree with all postmodern formulations of that, or with all formulations, therefore, that relativize knowing. That's another issue. But it is right to say that all human knowing is culturally constrained. After all, language itself is a cultural phenomenon. Since all human knowing takes place within the context of some language or other, inevitably, all human knowing is culturally constrained. And it is right to be reminded of that. There is a sense in which modern epistemology deified human finitude, and postmodern epistemology has debunked the self-deification. That's not all bad. On the other hand, number one, postmodern epistemology regularly exaggerates the difficulty of communication, whether from individual to individual, or from culture to culture, or from race to race, or from language to language, or from interpretive community to interpretive community. It regularly exaggerates the difficulties that are involved. And it tends to do this, it seems to me, by introducing an antithesis which is profoundly mistaken and which must be constantly exposed. The antithesis that it deploys all the time is this: either you may understand something truly and absolutely, or you are necessarily sunk in a swamp of relativism. That's the antithesis. Either you may know something omnisciently, let me put it that way, absolutely, or there is no true knowing. If you buy into that antithesis, the postmodern will always win every argument. Because you can always show that no human being ever knows anything omnisciently. Nevertheless, before you start thinking of alternative ways of casting the issue, I will come to it positively in a moment, you have to face the fact that at a certain kind of level, the sheer street experience that we have shows that communication is possible, however difficult. When I wrote the book The Gagging of God, in preparation for writing that book, I read about 1,100 books and articles. And the most important books, I checked out the major reviews as well. And what I discovered, of course, you always do, is that sometimes reviewers so attract the ire of the author that they write into the journal where the book was reviewed to contradict the reviewer. So, some postmodern would write a book, and then it would be reviewed nastily somewhere, and the postmodern author would reply then with a long response to the reviewer. Not once did I come across a situation where the postmodern author who replied to a review said, "Well, clearly the reviewer has understood my text in a way differently from what I meant, but that's understandable because postmodernism does teach us that we're separate interpretive communities, and as a result, it's not surprising that we look at things a little bit differently. I would like to engage this person in conversation to say what I..." Not once! No. In every case, it was, "Did this reader actually read the book? Didn't he notice that on page 362, footnote 47, what I really said was, if he had understood what the categories were and all that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da?" You see, what is being claimed here? What is being claimed by this postmodernist is that texts have meaning which can be discerned. And that meaning is bound up, if you please, with authorial intent. Stick that in your postmodern pipe and smoke it. You see? I mean, that's what's being said. Which is quite funny, really. Isn't it? Which suggests that despite the theory, communication is possible. It's not easy or guaranteed or simple, and errors can be made, but it's possible. And so that we rightly hold reviewers to account if they really don't understand the material or if they twist it or distort it, you see? And postmodern writers do that as much as anybody else, as far as I can see. I read a lot of this stuff before it dawned on me that this absolute antithesis is what is controlling things. I'll tell you the book that I was reading when it dawned on me. It came like a flash of light. I was reading one of the books of Paul Leman in Cambridge University Library. And in this book, at this point, Leman, who worked in the United States for a long time, though he's French, Paul Leman, he used an example from Archie Bunker. Now, many of us in Europe have been secured from knowing anything about Archie Bunker. But in order to explain this illustration, I need to explain who Archie Bunker is. Archie Bunker is a figure in a situational comedy on television. It's now off the air, but for many years it was quite funny and quite well done. Archie Bunker was a quintessential right-wing redneck. Does that expression mean anything to you? A sort of a blue-collar, beer-drinking, football-watching, anti-intellectual, knock-down-the-little-woman... Hard hat, you got it. He was all of those things, you see. And then his wife, inevitably, was a sort of quintessential twit. I mean, not quite with it, and a bit slow, and exists primarily to bring him his beer and his slippers. And then his daughter is pretty but stupid, and his son is a great big lazy oaf. And the whole situation actually really was quite funny because the script writers were really quite good. And what they were really doing was taking the mickey out of this sort of vision of reality. You see, it was really a spoof of the whole thing, and it was over the top. But as situation comedies go, it went on for years and years and years because they really did have a good set of writers with them, and it actually had quite a lot of social impact. It was really quite funny. Now, Paul Leman refers to a scene in Archie Bunker in which Edith, the wife, brings in Archie's bowling shoes, the shoes that he uses to go bowling. She's just polished them. She's just cleaned them. Because, of course, in Archie Bunker's world, real men never clean their own shoes. That's what the little woman is for. And so she brings in Archie's shoes, and she says in this whiny voice, "Archie, do you want your boots laced up or down?" And he says, "Ah, what's the difference?" She says, "Well, Archie, if you lace them up, you start with the bottom holes, but you come up first, and then you cross over and you go down, then you cross again and you come up, but if you're going to lace them down, you start with the bottom holes, but you go down first, and then..." And now the track is laughing away, ha, 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 ha. Because, Paul DeMond says, everybody understands that when Archie Bunker says, "Ah, what's the difference?" what he means is, I quote Paul DeMond, "I don't give a damn." But that's not how Edith has taken it. Edith says, in effect, to herself, when Archie says, "Ah, what's the difference?" he needs an explanation of the difference between lacing them up and down. Now, from this misunderstanding on Edith's part, Paul DeMond goes on for pages of the most erudite discussion until he comes up with what he calls the vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration. It takes some patience to read the deconstructionists. Vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration. Vertiginous, as in a cliff that is vertiginous, very vertical slope. Vertiginous possibilities, a huge gap, a cliff of a gap between what Archie is referring to, referential matters, and what she is referring to. You see? A vertiginous gap of referential possibilities. Pages of this stuff. Well, I finally got to the end of it, and I burst out laughing in Cambridge Library, checked back the book, and never finished it. I mean, I just could not finish reading trash like that. I mean, it was so stupid. Because, after all, the whole point of the humor was that Edith is a twit. The only person who did not understand what he was talking about was Edith, and she wasn't supposed to because she's a twit. That's why the laugh track is going. That is, everybody else did understand it. That's why it was funny. The only other person who didn't understand it was Paul DeMond. And you read enough of these discussions and you just go bananas, you see? And in every case, what they're trying to do is force you into a vision in which everything is absolutely clear and there is a universal transformation of all levels of meaning and there is absolute clarity and there is an omniscient transfer of omniscient knowledge from one finite knower to another finite knower, or you've got vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration. See, it's the antithesis all the time that is being foisted on you. And if you buy into the antithesis, obviously the postmodern will always win, because you can always show that in any communicative act or in any attempt to know anything, a finite being never gets it all. But that does not mean that we cannot know some things truly. It just means that we cannot know anything omnisciently. Now that means it becomes extraordinarily important for thinking through models of epistemology that are more reasonable. And there have been quite a few that have been generated. In the German world, the hermeneutical problem was challenged by what came to be called distanciation and the fusion of horizons. Now, there were German words for it. The fusion of horizons came to be Horizontsverschmelzung. And so on. But whether you remember the names, it doesn't really matter. It's an argument by analogy. So that, let's say, the Apostle Paul is, in his understanding of something or other, as he writes, let's say, Romans, it's as if Paul is looking out on a horizon. He's looking out on a world, and he sees certain things. That's what he sees, because of his place in history and his understanding and whatever God has given him and his experiences in the Damascus Road and understanding of the Romans. And all that he is, all that he understands, as he puts pen to paper, in fact, or as he dictates the letter to Tertius, in fact, that's his horizon of understanding. Now, as I look out on the world, from my perspective, I have a different horizon of understanding. I mean, I'm a 21st century person, and I was born in the middle of the last century, and I look at things a certain way, I have a different language, and so on. So the question is, how can he transfer stuff from his horizon of understanding to my horizon of understanding? And the model that was worked out was by distanciation and the fusion of horizons. That is, I must now distance myself in some ways from my own horizon of understanding. The way I do that is by trying to find out more how Paul's language works. I learn Greek, and I learn Hellenistic philosophy, and I learn Jewish sources, and I learn what he would have learned as a rabbi, and I examine how he uses his terminology. And gradually, see, I distance myself from my sets of categories, so far as that's possible. It's never possible exhaustively. There's this appeal to omniscience again. But in substantial part, I distance myself from my horizon of understanding and fuse now my now distanced self-understanding, my now distanced horizon, with his in some substantial way so that you can get substantial transfer across. It will never be perfect. It will never be exhaustive. But you can get some true transfer. Do you see? Or another model, starting with a hermeneutical circle that goes round and round and round and round, you revise it so that it becomes a hermeneutical spiral. It's not as if you go round and round and round at the same distance all the time from any objective reality, but you do circle in to know a little more. Isn't that also our experience of learning things? You see, you begin with a new discipline. I don't care what the discipline is. And it all seems very foreign. When I started reading serious literature in the domain of postmodernism, it took me a long time to get through some of those books, especially when I started reading the French ones. You know, Jacques Derrida. I read Derrida first of all in English, didn't understand him, so I read him in French, and I still didn't understand him. And I keep reading him and reading him until I figured out how he was using language, what he was doing with his stuff. You know, and eventually I got him, but it took me a long time. He's not easy to read. On the other hand, after you've read 50 books in the area of postmodernism, the next ones are a lot easier. You start going, read that, seen that stuff before, another discussion. You find out one chapter that's saying something a little bit new, you see, and that's how you start knocking off 8 or 10 books a day. You're not reading every page anymore. It's not worth it. You're a pile of junk in terms of what you've already read, you see. It's not saying anything new. But that's true in every discipline, isn't it? You start reading Greek, you know, luo, lues, lue, luemon, luete. Luce. Boy, how am I going to memorize this? Good grief. Luo. I mean, isn't that the way? Or you start learning any German or anything else. It doesn't really matter, does it? And then 13 weeks later, into the course, you know, you're struggling with the finer points of participles, and you know your verb paradigms, and you're struggling with me verbs or something. And what seems so daunting becomes part of the baggage, you see? Well, likewise, when you start approaching and understanding a text, you may be a long way out, but you do spiral in. You may never have an exhaustive and complete knowledge of something, but you do get some true knowledge of something, don't you? But the model that I like best, I confess, is one that was developed, in fact, by Karl Popper in the domain of the philosophy of science, and I'd just like to adopt it to other kinds of things. Picture an XY axis, okay? And on this scale, you're dealing with time. And on this scale, you are measuring the distance in your knowledge from actual reality. Distance from actual reality, as an omniscient mind would know that reality. All right? Now then, picture little Johnny. Brought up in a Christian home. He's 5 or 6 years old. Brought up in a Christian home, properly catechized. Says his prayers at night. Reads the Bible with mommy and daddy. Goes to a nice church with a fine Sunday school teacher. And you come into this home and you say, Johnny, do you believe that God loves you? Yes. Do you believe that Jesus loves you? Yes. How do you know? Well, he thinks and he thinks well. I mean, we sing in Sunday school, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Oh? Where does the Bible say that God loves Johnny? And he thinks and he thinks again. I don't know. I don't know. Well, then why do you believe that the Bible tells you that God loves Johnny? Well, the Bible says that God so loved the world, that I'm part of the world, so God loves me too. Question. Does Johnny understand John 3:16, which he has just quoted? Now, if you're a postmodernist, gifted in deconstruction, you will proceed along the following lines. Doesn't Johnny bring to the discussion a pretty primitive, infantile view of love? I mean, love means cuddles from mommy and daddy, cookie and milk before he goes to bed. God loves me? I mean, what does he think about God loving him, for goodness sake? What does he mean by God? A great grandfather image in the sky? How accurate a representation is that of whatever it was that John was saying? Does he understand anything of the disputes in the last century over the meaning of the verb agapao? God so loved the world. World. I mean, how big is the world in his view? And does he understand in any case that for John, cosmos is not so much a measure of bigness, but of badness? When we read God so loved the world, we're not to admire God's love because the world is so big, but to admire God's love because the cosmos is so bad. Does he think of himself as bad? Hmm? 20 verses on, it says the wrath of God abides on those who do not believe the Son. How does he reconcile in Johannine theology the love of verse 16 and the wrath of verse 36? Hmm? Does he understand John 3:16? Wouldn't that make a good deconstructionist? Hmm? But surely this is again the same trick. It's insisting that you have well-nigh omniscient knowledge or you got nothing. And I would want to say, of course Johnny understands the text. He's about here on the graph. You know, he's 5 years old. He's pretty distanced from, you know, the text as God understands it. Yeah, he understands it. He's in the right quadrant. He doesn't think that the verse is actually talking about the virgin birth of Christ or about the sex life of sea turtles in the South Pacific. You see, I mean, he doesn't think the text is talking about that. He's in the right quadrant. He's basically got it, you see? And now he grows up and he goes to your Bible Institute and eventually comes to Trinity for a PhD in Johannine theology against Jewish background, and I supervise him. And I mean... finishes his PhD. Now does he understand the text?
Yeah.
I would like to think that he understands it better than when he was 5. But he still hasn't touched the text. Do you see? He's moving like this. Mathematically, that's called an asymptotic approach. That's an asymptote. It's supposed to be an A. My handwriting is almost as bad as my speech. With an asymptote, it gets closer and closer and closer, but it never touches. So 50 billion years into eternity, if we may think of eternity in terms of the passage of years, does he now understand John 3:16 perfectly?
Nope.
Because omniscience is an incommunicable attribute of God. Oh, wait a minute, you say, what about 1 Corinthians 13? You know, now we know in part, then we shall know even as also we are known. 1 John 13 is not promising omniscient knowledge. It is promising unmediated knowledge. Now we see through a glass, a mirror, darkly. All of our knowledge of God is mediated. Then, face to face. What we shall have is unmediated knowledge. We will never have omniscient knowledge. Omniscience is an attribute of God, an incommunicable attribute of God. That is, an attribute of God that cannot be shared. Some attributes of God can be shared with other beings. So the texts can say, "Be holy as I am holy. Be perfect as I am perfect." They do not say, "Be omniscient because I am omniscient." Omniscience is an incommunicable attribute of God. So for all eternity, neither you nor I nor Johnny will ever have an omniscient knowledge of John 3:16. But does that mean we do not have a true knowledge of it? You see, it means we don't have a true knowledge of it only if we've bought into the antithesis. That the only way you can speak of true knowledge is by insisting that it be omniscient knowledge. But that's merely part of the postmodern agenda. It is a huge mistake and has to be blown up and overthrown again and again and again and again. Now then, there are some huge implications, it seems to me, for our response to postmodernism along these lines in terms of how we start getting across Christian truth, Christian thinking again. It seems to me that it turns finally on questions of worldview formation. But if you will permit me, I'm going to take half an hour at the beginning of next day to go down along those lines. And it affects how we think about evangelism and how we think about worldview formation, how we think about meta-narrative and things along that line. Do you mind if I extend a little bit? Now, that means, Mary, too, that so far as the taping is concerned, you might want to be very careful how those tapes get labeled. It could be very frustrating for somebody thinking they're going to get the use of the Old Testament and the New Testament to be introduced to meta-narrative. All right? So we'll come back to this one tomorrow.